Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to 88.5 KRFY for Community Conversations. I'm today's host, Chris Bessler. Today we conclude our four-week series of interviews covering contested races in the upcoming November 3rd election. Today we talk with candidates for District 1 Idaho Legislature House Seat B, the incumbent Republican Sage Dixon, his Democratic opponent, Stephen Hallett, and the third write-in candidate, Dan Rose. We have a good exchange of ideas and positions on issues, ranging from the state's handling of its COVID-19 response to education, highways, taxes, and more. In previous weeks, we've aired interviews with the candidates for the other contested races that will be on the ballot, which includes the Idaho Senate and House Seat A. We also talked with candidates in the Bonner County Sheriff's race, as well as the Bonner County District 1 Commissioner race. If you missed those interviews, they are available on our website at www.krfy.org as recorded podcasts. The election is coming right up on November 3rd, and here's a bit of election info. In Bonner County, you can vote in person on Election Day from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. at your regular polling place. You also have the option to vote early, in person, beginning October 19th at the Bonner County Elections Office at 1500 Highway 2 in Sandpoint. And if you wish to vote by absentee ballot, you can request your absentee ballot up until October 23rd and make sure your ballot is returned by November 3rd. You can request a ballot by going to Idaho's official elections website at idahovotes.gov. At idahovotes.gov, you may also register to vote or just check to ensure that you're registered, as well as look up your polling place. One more good resource locally is the Sandpoint Online Election Central, where there are details for voting and registration, as well as information on all the candidates with links to their websites, plus links to these KRFY podcasts as well. Get to Election Central at www.sandpointonline.com. And with that, let's get started on today's interview with the candidates for Idaho 1st District House of Representatives Seat B. We're speaking now with the three candidates for Idaho Legislature District 1 House Seat B. We have with us the incumbent Republican, Representative Sage Dixon. Sage, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate you hosting this event.
And also in our conversation today is the Democratic candidate for this seat, Stephen Hallett. Stephen, thank you for participating.
Well, good morning, Chris, and to the other voters of District 1. Thank you for tuning in.
And finally in our talk today is Dan Rose, who is a write-in candidate for this position. Dan, thank you for being here.
Good morning, and thank you, Chris.
Okay, so I want to say at the outset here that my goal today is to give each of you exactly equal time to speak to and address the issues we're going to be talking about. With three candidates and just 1 hour to cover a bunch of issues, we hope, that means we must observe time limitations to answer questions. You're going to have about a minute and a half each to speak uninterrupted for each question. If you wish to rebut something an opponent has said, you'll have 1 minute. Everybody gets one rebuttal, and then we'll move on to the next question or issue, and that's necessary just so we can cover several things and not get stuck on just one or two discussions here. So, to start off our talk today, we'd like to start with opening statements. Basically, an open mic for you for a minute and a half to introduce yourselves to the voters. Aside from giving some background on yourself with this opening statement, tell us why you're running. And let's start with you, Sage.
Well, thanks, Chris. Little bit of background. I am married. I have 7 children. We live north of Sandpoint. We've been in the area for 18 years now. I am an electrician by trade. I studied finance in college, and then because of the duties of the legislature, I had to stop my contracting business, and I got into financial services again. So I've kind of come full circle at this point. Doing insurance work and financial services allows me to come and go in the legislature, which is a necessity. As you said, I'm the incumbent. I've been serving this area for 3 terms, which is 6 years, and I'm anxious to serve another term. I think there's still some things that can be done in the legislature to reflect the needs of our constituents up here, and I know there's a lot of issues that constituents contact me about that I'm still anxious to work on, and sometimes things don't happen quickly, so it's nice to have the opportunity to keep working on those issues. And I'll stop there since we've got a short time span. I think my work speaks for itself, what I've done and how I've served this district. So I'd like to continue doing that.
Okay. Thank you, Sage Dixon.
Same question to you now, Stephen Hallett. Open mic here for a minute and a half. Tell us a bit about your background and experience and why you're running.
Hi, good morning. My name's Stephen Hallett, and I'm a Democrat. I will pose the direct opposite in most cases to the viewpoints delivered by the incumbent. I'm a building and remodeling contractor. I moved to Idaho in 1969. And up here into District 1 in 1977. I've been an Idaho resident for 51 years and self-employed for the last 35. Part of the things that I've done while I'm up here, I've been the chairman of the Parks and Recreation Department in Boundary County. I've volunteered for 17 years on Boundary Volunteer Ambulance as an EMT and an EMTA, serving in helping the health cares of people in need for emergencies. The reason I'm running is to give a voice to the voters who haven't been heard by our Idaho legislative government. And I think it works both when you have an ample and even count of legislators and senators of opposing viewpoints. I believe that the protection of individuals, the communities, and the common assets are the only legitimate and good reasons for government. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen Hallett. And now, Dan Rose, please start off by telling us a bit about your background, experience, and why you're running.
Yes, good morning. My name is Dan Rose. I am married with three children. I've lived in Idaho for 6.5 years now. I will attempt to offer, refer to myself on occasion here in the third person, as the greatest hurdle to my candidacy is not being on the ballot. So forgive me if the name Dan Rose comes out many times more than the term I. I'm an elected and vetted constitutional liberty conservative. I've been elected to the Pender Lake Hospital District as a trustee and a three-term Grouse Creek Precinct Committeeman. My volunteer community service for the past 5 years has been extensive, and it benefits veterans, taxpayers, neighbors, and the Republican Party. Why I'm running, the voters of the legislative district are entitled to courageous representation in defense of the Constitution. Voters want solutions and not excuses. Between the Daily Bee Reader and the KRFY question and answers, in the meetings with constituents, I have illuminated both my solutions and the incumbent's excuses. I wish to offer the constituents of Legislative District 1 as an option to the current incumbent representation, and that is why I'm running. Issues that occurred since the entry into the race, which the deadline was March 13th, have mounted in a way that we didn't see what was coming then, and now we know. And my entry into the race is a product.
I have to break in there, Dan. We're at time now, but that leads us right up to the next question I have for you guys, and that is, what are the 2 to 3 issues you think are most important in this race? And Dan, since you were kind of going there anyways, why don't you start out? I'm going to rotate who goes first each time. So, Dan Rose, let us know what you think the 2 or 3 most important issues are in this race. A minute and a half, please.
Sure. Yeah, the 3 issues that I see most important would be, A, terminating the statewide emergency, and therein the governor's executive department, health and welfare's ability to violate constitutional rights. Toward that goal, we need to unseat Speaker Bedke. $1,500 of campaign influence contributions from Speaker Bedke to Representative Dixon, proximate to the June and August reconvening sessions, and a campaign and a Bedke chairmanship assignment to Representative Dixon will continue to support the status quo failures. The legislature also needs to separate counsel from the AG's office and the AG's budget. The incumbent has stated recognition of the AG problem, but fails to present any solution. I suggest that solution is located in Idaho Code 67-1401, paragraph 13. Secondly, educational choice legislation. The Boys Knee Establishment will be dragging their feet for the benefit of status quo. During the month of November, I will draft legislation with LSO that state education funding dollars will follow the student through an educational savings account, voucher program, or a tax and tax exemption status. Number three would be a list of property and sales tax reforms that will alleviate taxpayer expenses, including grocery tax, rebate amounts, alcohol tax, California Prop 13, foregone tax, and all those I believe you'll probably ask as different questions.
Okay. Thank you for that, Dan Rose. Stephen Hallett, now, same question to you. What do you believe are the 2 to 3 issues that are most important in this race? A minute and a half, please.
I believe, first off, that representation that can at least breach in conversation both sides of the aisle and entertain good laws when good laws are presented, which include education, the access to health care. When voters vote in health care, it's not to be undermined by work orders or funding shortcomings. The people wanted health care. They got it in the vote. The legislature did everything that they could to dismantle it, and that was led by Sage. I believe that's what he believes in. Putting public lands and economic interests on equal grounds, protecting of the environment, and a commitment to repair our crumbling highway infrastructures. I believe that the traditional agriculture and forest product industries need to also be protected. That is the lifeblood of our economy. In modding, businesses need to be attracted so that our college students can then come back home to Idaho and live. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Stephen Hallett. Sage, your turn.
Thanks, Chris.
Issues you think are most important.
Okay. Many of the things mentioned are already things that we've been working on, so it's nice to know that these gentlemen are interested in similar things, and there's plenty of legislation out there to address each one of those topics. I do think property taxes is one of the largest issues. It's been a little bit overshadowed by the COVID issue right now, but there's a working group going on right now that'll be presenting some suggestions perhaps in January. That's not always a solution, but there's folks in the legislature looking at that now, many of us doing that. I serve on the tax committee, so I'm well aware of those issues and looking for those solutions as well. I think there is a large issue with the power that the executive branch has under the declared emergency and an extreme emergency. That was a large problem for many people in the state. And the legislature needs to be involved in doing that. So I'm sure that's going to be a large topic as well going forward. Executive branch needs the ability to move quickly, but the duration of that needs to be shortened dramatically so that when decisions are being made for the entire state, the representatives of everybody in the state have a say in what's going to be happening in doing that. Those are the top two things. Something to consider is, as I mentioned earlier, my opening constituent services. You need to be able to listen to people in this district. It may not always be something that you're interested in, but that's part of our service and our responsibility as elected representatives is serving the people of this district, trying to fix problems with the state government that happen. And I derive the greatest satisfaction of this work in doing that. So that's something to keep in mind as far as going forward.
Okay, thank you. Stephen Hallett, you're asking for a rebuttal time, so you get 1 minute.
Yes, yeah, Sage, your request of lessening the executive branch's power is a direct attack on the U.S. Constitution and the state constitution of separation and equal powers of the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. You claim to be constitutionally minded, but yet the first thing you want to do is to undermine the constitutional strengths as well as introducing laws that break constitutional amendments and then claim that it was passed in the House. We should have the ability to pass what we want. The ability to pass what you want has to fall within the brackets of the Constitution.
Okay. Well, Sage, you get a minute for response.
Thank you for that interesting response. I think there's many that feel that that's the exact opposite of what's happening, and we've experienced executive branch overreach consistently. I'm not undermining the Constitution or separation of powers. We need to be involved in those decisions. There's too much in the executive branch at this point when it comes to the declared emergency declaration. So I'm not removing that authority. I think it is an important authority for a short duration because the legislature cannot act quickly, but when decisions are being made for everybody in the state, that is our role as elected representatives to represent our constituents in doing that. So I would contend with you on that, and I'm sure we can go farther.
I'm sure we could.
Okay, thank you. And Dan Rose, you have a minute if you want to weigh in on this particular question.
Okay, the legislative branch is the only part-time operating branch in the state government. They have been at a severe disadvantage in representing the people during this crisis. I can tell you that the Supreme Court has issued orders, and they've put restrictions on due process violations, or have created due process violations as well. So it's the governor and the court that are actually operating against the citizens. And the legislature not being present on a full-time basis is severely disadvantaged. And that is a constitutional measure that I believe Sage is acting on, that I think Steve is misunderstanding.
All right, thank you all three for that. And this actually segues pretty nicely into our next question here. And I believe we start first with you on this one, Stephen. COVID-19, of course, the coronavirus is a major issue for our state and the whole country and the whole world, as it actually is. What is your take on how Governor Brad Little has handled the COVID crisis with his stage reopening? Would you give him thumbs up or thumbs down, or would you be doing things differently?
I think right off the bat, we were all taken aback by the severity of it, the unknowns of the COVID-19. Governor Little, in my opinion, has taken the right approach. I would have followed the CDC recommendations had I been in his position. And I think his cautious approach of reopening Idaho and allowing the economy to grow and given guidelines based on healthcare and science is well taken. I wish more people would volunteer on an own basis to do that. I think areas like supermarkets and other stores that gather a lot of people should require masks as entrance just to protect the other people if you don't want to protect yourself.
Okay, thank you, Stephen, for that. Same question to you, Dan Rose. What is your take on how Governor Brad Little has handled the COVID-19 crisis with his stage reopening? Do you approve his handling, or would you do it differently? That's you, Dan Rose.
Yes, Steve. Chris, I believe the governor has mismanaged this. At first, I would have given him a couple weeks to do what he did. But as I initiated action in the Central Committee and with Sage Dixon and Speaker Bedke in April, I asked for reconvening the legislature so that they could weigh in. In the emergency side of the House, the first couple weeks to a month, I'll give the governor. Beyond that, he was required to call the legislature back by code. He did not. The legislature failed to call themselves back, in part due to Sage's irresponsible action. I think Mr. Howlett's response is a collectivist approach. I don't agree with it. I believe currently that in April, I didn't agree that the numbers warranted the action that the governor took. And I believe now, certainly, they don't. 29 of the 44 counties at 66% have five or fewer deaths related to COVID-19. And that depends on how you determine COVID-19 deaths. So 66% of the population of the is not a scientific justification for what has been done.
Okay. Thank you for that. And to you, Sage, the same question. What's your take on how Governor Brad Little has handled the COVID crisis to this point?
I think initially there was a huge question mark on what was going on. And I think in that role as governor and being responsible for the whole state, it's a tough position to be in. And making those decisions that he did. I've said multiple times, I think that's the initial decision and what I was just describing as far as the time length in that. A couple weeks to figure out what's going on, to see what this is. Obviously, Blaine County was a huge issue. That needed to be addressed immediately. Ada County was growing. But multiple areas in the state were seeing nothing, and especially us in District 1. So something that was being advocated for by myself and others throughout the state is to treat each location differently. In doing that, we were repeatedly asking the governor to reconvene us. We were rebuffed at each time in doing that. There is some fringe ideas about the legislature could get itself together because we're under attack, and that's just not the case. So through the pressure of the legislature and so the House GOP caucus met and discussed this issue of the governor not bringing the legislature into this discussion so that we could represent our people. We had five working groups. Those working groups came up with proposed legislation that pressured the governor into calling a special session where we were able to address some topics, not every topic we wanted to, of course, but some topics that were important at that time. So going forward, I think that time length for the executive branch to act in an emergency should be 2 weeks. That's what I've been saying. I think at that point, the legislature needs to be involved. And there are differences between local disasters and emergencies and statewide ones as well. So some differentiation needs to be made there.
Okay, thank you.
Is that the stop sign?
Okay. Folks can't see it. We're on Zoom. I am waving at people when we're hitting the time limit here. I do appreciate you guys observing that. Let's have a little follow-up question on that. We're coming into winter when more people are going to be indoors. Our statewide rates for COVID are staying high. They're among the highest in the country. Would you look for different set of ways to react to COVID as we enter winter and with a more likely a higher infection rate coming our way? And then secondary question here, we'll start out with you, Sage, on this one, is do you see specific COVID-related issues that the next session of legislature will be or should be dealing with? Two-part question.
Sure. Next session, well, that's the first part. If we see a rise again, I think it's important, and the role of government should be to inform people and inform them correctly about the dangers. I don't think mandates and forcing people to do things against their will are ever a good solution, especially in our constitutional republic. So part of our role would be to stay, protect yourself and think about your neighbors as well. Be a responsible individual and going forward so that you are taking care of things if you think you're sick or something like that. So I am concerned with the governor making some more overreaching efforts if we do have a rise again coming up. I do think there'll be legislation to address a number of things that we've seen with COVID. This was unforeseen. We as a state have done some very good things to protect individual liberties and personal choice, but this exposed a whole lot more, and I'm certain we'll be addressing that as well.
Thank you, Sage Dixon, for that. Stephen Hallett, same question to you. We're coming into winter. What should the state be doing if our COVID rates balloon up, which is a possibility? Do you see COVID-related issues that the next legislature should be dealing with?
Chris, it's flu season coming up, and regular flu is also going to be a complication to COVID. I think we should take the precautions of the CDC. Now, whether you listen to government leaders or listen to religious leaders or just your own inner head, I believe science has the answer. And if they suggest using a mask out in public and in close contact, I believe we should follow that. Now, the legislator is going to have to look at ways to fix and pay for some of these PPEs that we've been having to use. And the other adjustments to daily life. That is going to come out in some kind of a funding vehicle. I'm not sure what it is. It could be cuts. It may be we bite the bullet and there's going to be some kind of a tax put on it. I don't know what it's going to look like. Nobody likes a tax, but we will have to pay for it.
Thank you for that. Dan Rose, now the same question to you. If we're coming into winter and we do see COVID rates ballooning up, what do you think the best course for the state is? And as well, are there specific COVID-related issues you think the legislature should be dealing with?
Yeah, again, if we listen to the governor, April 20, 24th area, and just recently in the last month. He said this won't be over until a vaccine is issued. I highly object to that. I suggest masking be voluntary only, no requirement anywhere. If you choose to wear a mask to protect yourself, that is individual responsibility. Contact tracing will be reporting only, no investigative ability and no extrapolation ability to impute actions or mandates on any other person. Vaccines will strictly be voluntary. No employee or patient shall be required to take a vaccine. Any student, employee, or person benefiting from government funding that suffers any loss of constitutional rights due to the vaccine is grounds for impeachment, as far as I'm concerned. The appropriations need to be done by the legislature and not the governor. And lockdowns and quarantines are unjustified and unconstitutional. I believe the state of emergency needs to be eliminated. If a county is so bad off that they want to affect a emergency by county, they have that ability. But as a statewide measure, it needs to be eliminated.
Okay, thank you, Dan Rose, for that. Stephen Hallett, you're asking for a rebuttal time.
Yes, Dan, that's an anarchist view to civil authority. Everyone wants their constitutional rights protected. But when it comes to the whole, I don't want someone unmasked coming into my supermarket and breathing on the produce and the food products that I'm going to be taking home and eating. I don't understand your viewpoint or how you could even understand breathing on someone else's food in the supermarket. That's a careless approach. I think you're uncaring, and I don't agree with your approach at all.
Okay, Dan Rose, you have a minute for
Chris,
rebuttal.
I'll just say that okay. We so haven't Sage, had those precautions.
Go ahead, Sage.
I was just going to say that they've not had those precautions, and people have been shopping and doing what they do normally for quite some time in this area, and there's no huge increase in COVID cases in doing that. So I think that's a bit extreme of an approach. And as people personal responsibility is where it needs to be, making those decisions for yourself. You can wash your food if you're that concerned about it when you get home. And I know a lot of the stores are taking those precautions, which is responsible for them as far as cleaning things more than they would as well. So I think that's a bit over the top, Steve.
And Dan Rose, you have a minute more on this
topic. Can I wait?
Yes. Go, Dan.
Yes, thanks. This identifies the very difference between Steve Howlett being a constitutional person and not. His intentions are to force issues on others and not obey the Constitution. And that's the hypocrisy of his position on the Constitution, as I see it.
All right. Thank you all for that. Various viewpoints on this. I'm going to ask one more question that's related to this before we move on. The governor convened a special session in the summer to deal with COVID-related issues. One of the things that occurred there, a group of folks that were upset, I think, mainly about the governor's handling of the coronavirus. They pushed into the hearing. It was a pretty unruly thing. At least it looked like that from up here. They broke a glass door. It looked like a breakdown in our civil processes. And I will start with you on this one, Sage. You were closest to it, I suppose. What is your take on that special session, both in terms of handling that incident and how citizens should express their differences with what's going on legislatively? And then, if you would, tell us, your take on what was accomplished in the session.
I was in my office when that happened. I heard everything happening. I went into the... into the committee room to see, and there were some unhappy people there. This was probably before, I think this was before we were on the floor and the glass got broken. I'm not sure. I didn't see the glass get broken. I just heard about it afterwards. I think there's a lot, I don't appreciate that type of behavior. I'll say that. I mean, there's one thing, regardless of where it comes from, because I think it's detrimental in the long term to our political process and to society as a whole. as we become more polarized and people are just hurling insults and stamping their feet about what they're not getting. I think that's improper. If those people had legitimate concerns, I'm sure they did. There were some things that they were told were happening that may have been happening, and they were trying to express their frustrations with that, and that is something that must be protected. To what extent that goes, I don't appreciate the extent that it went to. And again, I'll say from either side, but I was compelled to go speak to those people to try and figure out what it was and try and help, but other representatives stepped in prior to that, and I didn't have that opportunity. That was probably a negative overall in regards to how the session went. I think that that special session wasn't broad enough. It addressed some things that were very immediate that needed to be addressed to bring confidence to businesses and to the economy. And then the House passed a measure that was pretty important and we felt was a legitimate measure to pass. We don't go forward and do things just to say, look at us. It was a well thought out measure by people who are cautious about what they do. And it was disappointing that the Senate got different information than we had and decided not to move forward with that. There's a lot of reasons why that happened. I'm sure we've heard about that, but those will all be things that are going to be addressed. And I'm wrapping it up right now.
Okay. Thank you. Dan Rose, same question to you. What is your take on the special session that was held, both in terms of handling that incident where things got unruly, as well as what was accomplished there?
Okay, Steve, Chris, I was not there at the event. My understanding is that that there was citizen allowed involvement in at another time, and then it was retracted so that they were restricted, and that upset them. I don't know how the glass got broken. I heard it was a big crowd. I don't agree with any violence. I think the state police handled it properly in bringing Mr. Bundy out in the chair. That was in a least intrusive way they could have dealt with it. I think they did. I think the session itself overall was a failure. I believe that there was constitutional authority under Article 3, Section 27, Paragraph 2, where the legislature had the ability to do other matters, and it was under the clause of would admit undue delay. 4 more months of the situation that we have right now is undue delay. That constitutional section fits this event, and I believe the legislature missed a great opportunity to assert their constitutional rights, and if that required a constitutional court challenge for the separation of powers, it should have been done. And it wasn't, and I think a missed opportunity is there, and we now continue to suffer.
Thank you, Dan Rose.
It looks like I might have clicked out.
No, you're good. We heard you. Yeah. Stephen Howlett, same question to you. Your take on the special session.
Well, I think the special session ended up being a certain kind of a show. Civil disobedience needs to be taken care of regardless of party, regardless of constituents. I thought that was a civil disobeying group out there, and they were destroying public property. Did they have access to the building under peaceful nature? Yes, they got in because they were peaceful in the beginning and they soon became violent. There wasn't any provisions meant for the public to view the special session. I think the state police didn't arrest enough people. As far as the special session being addressed, the governor addressed it for two specific reasons, liability for businesses and how to do voting by mail. And those were the only categories under consideration for the legislature, and the Attorney General's office backed that up as an interpretation of the special session. Once again, legislative bodies do have the right to come up with ideas that challenge the executive, which they were within their rights to do. But when the Attorney General came back and said, no, you can't do that, then everybody has hard feelings. I think it was less than stellar performance by the star characters on all sides, public, government. I hope that if I get into that situation, I'll be able to act a little bit differently.
Okay. Yes, Sage.
I just want to flush something out, but the public was there. They were in the committee rooms, and they were in the gallery at each time. So there was public access. There was a misunderstanding in the first day in the committee room, because we do not allow testimony on what's called a print hearing when we're deciding whether a bill can or an idea can become a bill. And so those people were frustrated. They didn't understand that. But the second day, when they were in a larger auditorium, there was some miscommunication, not a miscommunication, but I think the people were sitting in one spot one day, and then the next day they sat there and were told not to. And that kind of precipitated what happened with Mr. Bundy that second day in doing that. So that's just a little, Dan was alluding to that, and he's correct as far as misinformation goes on that second day and what happened. So that's just a little bigger picture.
And Ammon Bundy was one of the protesters who was arrested at that.
Right. He's the one that remained in the chair and did not leave until ISP came and removed him and the chair.
And the chair. Just rolled him out. Okay. Stephen, you do have a minute for rebuttal, and Dan as well, if you want to add more on this.
Dan, go ahead. I'm satisfied with my answer to that.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. I do believe that the Attorney General got it wrong, and so did the legislative body that accepted their eunuch position. The Attorney General never mentioned the legislative authority in the opinion he gave to the Senate pro tem. And that legislative authority is Article 3, Section 27.2. He only commented on Article 4, Section 9, the governor's ability to call the session. So the Attorney General, who is representing the legislature or the Senate pro tem in the opinion question, completely missed and avoided the legislative authority in the question. I find that is just absolutely unbelievable. I believe Steve's comment of more people should have been arrested is a statist approach. I don't agree with that. I believe it was handled properly, and I wish the legislature had done a better job.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to another issue here. Education is the biggest part of the state budget. And we'll start with you, Stephen, on this one. What would you like to see the state be doing differently in terms of education and funding education? Also, it was just reported, the state's to date this year, it's running a budget surplus of over $500 million. Do you think part of that should be channeled to education?
Okay, thank you, Chris. As far as the budgeting goes, with the cuts in the next fiscal year coming at 5% evenly for each department, I wouldn't ask for anything more than the reestablishment of that 5% if possible. Surpluses are a matter of how you do your accounting. Oftentimes, budgets are passed, and they said they've exhausted their surplus, but yet they find that they have a balance still left over. Well, I think I would go for at least 50% of that surplus back to reestablishing the 5% of each of the departments across the state. As far as further funding of the school districts, I think that the first thing that needs to be considered is reestablishing the budget for secondary schools, universities. Next, I think we need to work hard on getting our kindergarten classes at full strength and funding that. That's a lot of money to get kindergartens up in every school district. And then I think that the state is lax in funding to the tune of what the levies cost the individual counties and school districts. I think we need to fund according to the school district levies, and also to have equal dollars follow each student throughout the state.
Okay, thank you, Stephen Hallett. Same question to you, Dan Rose. Do you feel that education is adequately funded? And also, we're running a budget surplus this year. Should more funding be channeled from that to the education budget? Dan Rose, please.
Yes, Chris, roughly $7,200 or 57% of the total state funding is allocated to K through 12 students, $3,700 of which accounts for teacher pay and benefits. I disagree with imputing onto the state financial obligations that individual school districts desire to be the proper funding amounts. I've been quite involved with LPOSD matters and have found expenses continue to rise and student populations continue to fall, and results are level. Recently, the AP reported an educational officials have approved the temporary legislation allowing schools to use their full-time equivalent enrollment numbers as opposed to average daily attendance. I believe this is a legislative matter that should have been taken place or put in that role. I believe that residents and taxpayers at the local level have the ability to shape and define their community desires. Centralizing educational funding beyond the amounts that we already have at the state level does not accomplish that. The 2020 SCOTUS opinion of Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue, as well as the governor's recent grant money, $50 million in grant money towards the Strong Families, Strong Students, sets a precedent that we can start moving money towards following the student. I will advocate for an education savings account, student voucher, and tax deduction for that cause.
Okay, thank you. Same question to you now, Sage Dixon. Do you feel education budget is set at the right place? Would like to see it increased or decreased? And also, we are looking at a budget surplus for the state of over $500 million. Would you use part of that money for education?
I do expect that 5% cut to be backfilled. I don't know if we'll backfill every agency in doing that with that surplus, because this is an opportunity to take a look at what's truly necessary. And having served on the budget committee for 2 years, there's been an effort recently to start to dig deeper into what we term the base. What is that? What are we actually starting with and what's necessary? So I don't know, and I've never been an advocate of just throwing money at things, because money is there. We need to be prudent going forward. We can expect another recession coming, and we thought that this COVID issue would hit us a lot harder than it did. Now, thankfully, because we were more open than a lot of our surrounding states, we've seen a great boon in our tax revenues coming in. Now, we put, every year since I've been in the legislature, at least $100 million extra dollars into education. So we've been pouring money into education consistently. There are needs there, but it's not a direct correlation between more money and better outcomes. I think if we're going to be putting more money into education, we need to have a sunset on it and to make sure that it's being used correctly rather than just filling things up and hoping it works out and doing that. The education savings account is something we've been working on for a good 4 or 5 years. Thanks to the Espinoza decision, that will make it a lot easier to have that happen now, because the Blaine Amendment was the one thing that was holding us up. I served on an interim committee that looked at the school funding formula, and our conclusion was that the money needed to follow the child. Now, there's a lot of different nuances that go into that, but that's the direction we're heading. That's why we went to the enrollment model from the average daily attendance model, and everything seems to be moving in a good direction to give parents more choice and still be able to provide for those that are using the public system.
Thank you. Let's move on to another topic now. And Sage, I think your turn to be first up here. Actually, we'll kind of continue that discussion in a way. I want to get your take on taxes in the state. Specifically, income taxes. One proposal from Reclaim Idaho is to increase taxes on wealthy individuals, specifically wealthy individuals, to allow more funding for schools. Do you think our tax structure is set at about the right place? Or would you like to see something differently done with taxation in the state? And can you also throw into your 90 seconds of reply, do you think the tax on groceries should be continued?
I would like to see a flat tax structure. I think that's the more most equitable and fair tax structure. And again, that's something that's been discussed for a while. It's difficult to get there. We have a very odd tax structure where you're in the highest bracket after $10,000. And we were able to bring it down a couple of years ago, both corporate and personal income tax. And we saw a huge boom in the economy from doing that. So any proposal that's going to raise income tax on corporations and anything else besides being, I mean, it sounds hyperbolic, but a Marxist way of doing things is going to severely harm the economy of this state, and especially where we are now. So I think that that's a bad idea going forward. Property taxes are something we definitely need to look at, because that's harmful. And if you're losing your property, that goes to the core of freedom at that point. Grocery tax. Yes, I think that needs to be removed. Now, that's a difficult proposal. But with these increases that we're seeing in funding coming into the state right now, it makes it a whole lot easier. And we did set up a fund because we're starting to get tax from internet sales now, and it was called the Taxpayer Relief Fund, specifically to help remove the tax on groceries in doing that. So that money is growing at a pretty good clip at this point. I'm sure we'll see it grow a lot. It's hard for us to get a handle on those numbers because there's proprietary information issues with the companies that do that. But I am still in favor of removing that sales tax on groceries.
Okay, thank you. Dan Rose, same question to you concerning taxes. One proposal out there is to increase taxes on wealthy individuals, specifically for schools in that case. But do you feel our tax structure is properly set? And second part of that question, would you continue the tax on groceries?
Yes, Chris, I do believe that the flat tax structure is appropriate. I did not agree with the Reclaim Idaho initiative, raising business taxes up to 8%, and also hitting personal incomes above $250,000. I don't believe that that's a good process. I've stated before several times that legislators need to stand up and oppose these initiative petitions when they're bad. This one is bad. I hadn't heard from others, but I did contribute letters to the editor on that proposal. Property taxes, in addition to the state tax for education, allows individual communities that can afford it the desire to place an emphasis on that expense. Education being an important expense, if you can provide for it, then you can do it. The grocery tax, I see, I'd like to have that eliminated. If it can't be eliminated, I would like to see that that the amounts of rebates to seniors remain the same, and in others that they be reduced. And actually, if you want to take I don't like the redistribution of wealth modeled in that grocery tax. And if it's at all possible, the taxpayer can receive exemptions by filing for such as they do the gasoline tax or the fuel tax. So again, I'd like to remove it. If not, I'd like to see additions made to the rebate.
Thank you, Dan Rose. Same question now to you, Stephen Hallett. Do you think the tax burden is appropriately set here in Idaho? And would you continue the tax on groceries?
Unlike the two predecessors, Dan and Sage, I am in favor of raising the corporate tax to help fund K-12 schooling. I think that the $250,000 income for extra tax is too low. I think we should have raised that up to the $500,000 per individual. And that way there, we would have some more relief for those in the lower budget and tax earnings. As far as online sales, like Sage mentioned, I think a full 6% is what they should be charged rather than whatever they negotiate. As far as the food tax, I think that should stay on the food, but I think in our personal income tax form that as residents, we should get a larger rebate to help offset that tax. I know in my own personal case, it doesn't come close to covering the food tax that I spend. So I think I would double it for our residents, and then the onus is on travelers that come through and outside residents paying it, and for the benefit of Idahoans and use of our roads.
Okay, thank you, Stephen Hallett. All right, let's turn off. We are going to have time for one more question here, and then we'll have time for some closing statements from each of you. We'll start with you on this question, Dan Rose. One of the most important functions of our state government is providing for highway construction and maintenance. How do you feel the state is doing with our transportation overall? And give us your take on that, please.
Sure, Chris. The highway transportation is the avenue of commerce for the state. I believe it's one of the more important items in the state budget, along with education. I believe that up here in this district, we're seeing some movement on the roads, the curve near MacArthur Lake, and I believe there's one issue coming to resolution south of the Sagal the bridge over Lake Pondere. The funding mechanism seems to be appropriate. There's monies coming in from set aside funds that have been many years in the making, and I would see that there's no problem with that at the moment. There's plenty of how do we say expenses needed around the state, so it's a limited pot to choose from, and we have to spread that around.
Okay, thank you. Sage Dixon, same question to you. Do you feel we're doing a good job in Idaho with our highways construction and maintenance?
Yes, I do, especially up north. We've been a beneficiary of a lot of projects, and there are going on now to make our travel between here and Coeur d'Alene, and actually just the whole commerce corridor up to Canada, very good. As Dan mentioned, MacArthur Road, that curve there that's been a dangerous curve, that'll be changing up. We'll go into those details. The hard thing is that it's hard to get movement on things that we need to get movement at the south end of the bridge there at Lakeshore Drive. Many people are frustrated with that, but the metrics just aren't there. And in a state this large, that's really the only equitable way that the transportation department can look at these things, is where is the most need in doing little projects like that. So that's the frustrating part for us in this district. Our other issue is, where's the funds coming from? With the advent of electronic cars and hybrid cars and just more fuel efficient cars, the tax or revenues derived from the fuels tax is not quite enough. So that's been a big discussion in the Transportation Committee and on the Budget Committee, and trying to find how are we going to fund this as our state is growing. Our needs are growing immensely in the southern part of the state and up in the in Kootenai County as well, and even in our area. So that's the big question mark going forward. Thankfully, we have the budget surplus, so that helps take care of local issues with the Strategic Initiatives Index. Some of that will be siphoned off to go to that, and that's something we need to redo, because that dropped off, actually. But we'll get one more shot at it in doing that. So it's a big state. There's lots of highways and little local districts that are dependent upon us for funds as well. But I think overall, things are going as well as they can.
Thank you. And Stephen Hallett, same question to you. What's your take on the state's highway construction and maintenance?
I think that the highway department is doing the best they can do, given the resources. Projects are often delayed or postponed based on something more pressing. I know that's how some of the projects up here, we mentioned MacArthur Curve. Other pressing issues come up, and so money is diverted or delayed. In Barnes Ferry, we've got a phase two that isn't happening. There isn't enough money allotted for the right-of-way purchases, so now we're being delayed for another two more years. In all the visible stuff we see, things appear to be going smoothly. What we don't see are the invisible structures of our bridges failing, and inventories have been taken, and it isn't until bridges are about to collapse and pose a harm to our population, that they get addressed. Now, I think we need to do better on our bridge replacement systems. I like the idea that bridges in our highway systems can have alternative sources of funding if counties can come in and help replace the bridges at a cheaper dollar rate and still acquire the structural integrity that's needed.
Okay, thank you for that, Stephen Hallett. We're about at end of our time here, guys. So we're gonna give you each, we have time for 1 minute from each of you for a final statement. Tell the voters what you would like them to know here. And Dan Rose, let's, the writing candidate, let's start with you. 1 minute, please.
Thank you, Chris. I would suggest caution on this budget surplus. We didn't get into it too much, but over the next several years, we're expected to possibly see recessional items. The current situation is alleviated by the COVID federal dollars, but beyond that, there's going to be an elastic effect, and we need to account for that. I am a pro-life from conception, an exemption only to the mom's health, mom's life. I'm church, pro-church, constitutional adherence, family rights, Second Amendment, Trump agenda, police, fiber optics, and small government. I ask that the question and answers of local media in this race, which include measuring the actions and statements made during the 2020 primary period by Representative Dixon, Mr. Howlett, and Dan Rose, be looked at. I respectfully ask that you check the write-in box and insert the name Dan Rose on the write-in line beneath the name Stephen and Sage for a state representative seat B position on your ballot. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Dan Rose. Sage Dixon, the Republican candidate. 1 minute, please.
Thanks, Chris, and I appreciate you doing this. It's really been the only opportunity that we've had to discuss things with each other, and that's important. I will say again, I believe my record speaks for myself, for my care for my constituency and my conservative values that I take down to Boise. I think it is imperative that the responsibility of this position be recognized. And you mentioned it earlier as a possible question about how do you deal with people maybe you don't agree with. Well, it's something that I do often, and I think people know that I field phone calls and communications frequently about issues from a wide variety of constituents, and I'm happy to do that in taking care of those things in this state. And I think that is something that's important and that I enjoy doing. I have a large voice down there. I think I can get things done still for our district and continue to help steer the state in a good direction. And I would appreciate another opportunity to keep doing this.
Sage Dixon, thank you for that. And finally, Stephen Hallett, the Democratic candidate, your closing statement.
Thank you, Chris. Sage, thank you for your participation, and Dan also. I support our traditional agriculture and forest product industries. The attraction of modern day businesses to offer our college graduates a place of employment in Idaho and to keep Medicaid health strong and funding and working for our Idaho families. And I hold government accountable in defending your rights. I support the increase in minimum wage. The public land use is a collaborative effort between all users and is not for sale. Education funding formulas to include students, teacher, and building maintenance should be included. And to keep our Constitution strong and whole, I support broadband access to all Idahoans, and then to perhaps put that with a matching grant system. I hope and urge you all to get out and vote November 3rd, and I hope you find Stephen Hallett the candidate of your choice. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Sage Dixon, Dan Rose, Stephen Hallett. It's a good conversation, and I certainly appreciate your participation. Bye now.
Thank you, Chris. Bye.
That's a wrap for our show today and our talk with the local candidates for Idaho House Seat B. This is Community Conversations on 88.5 KRFY, and I'm Chris Bessler. Remember, if you missed part of this, you can hear the recorded podcast on our website at www.krfy.org and click on the podcast page. Meantime, be sure to tune in each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. for more community conversations. Thank you for listening today.